Welcome to the Voice Weekly Podcast, coming to you from the Voice of San Francisco, a nonprofit independent news source for the city by the bay. I'm Melissa Kane, political analyst, lawyer, and all-around nerd.
And I'm your co-host, John Zipperer, editor of the Voice of San Francisco. You can find this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and wherever else you get your favorite podcasts. If we could ask you a favor, it would be that you subscribe to us and leave a positive review, which is very important for helping other people find and enjoy The Voice Weekly.
Last week, we talked with election analyst David Latterman about the city's historical voting patterns. And as we look forward to this November's election, you don't have to be an expert to know that housing will be a central issue.
And just as Americans will never stop arguing over issues like abortion and taxes, San Franciscans have an internal forever war going on over housing.
And while we're always at war, it's not always easy to know what the battlefield looks like. We read that housing is booming, that it's busting, that no one can get insurance. And now we have this National Association of Realtors settlement added to this mix. Now, John actually knows this topic incredibly well and even wrote a piece for the Voice of San Francisco on the subject. So we're going to have him talk about real estate in San Francisco and how the NAR settlement will or won't change things. John, take it away.
Thank you, Melissa. I think we all perhaps saw the Chronicle article recently reporting on the opening of a small village of tiny homes for homeless people in the Mission District. There will be 60 homes once it's all filled, plus some communal and management space, all created for a cost of about $113,000 per tiny home, which is much more than similar projects in Oakland and San Jose. And after all of that expense, including almost $3 million a year to run the site, it'll all close down in 2 years and be replaced by an affordable housing development. So I've reported on real estate, both for the affordable housing market as well as market rate housing and even more broadly, just commercial real estate for decades. And San Francisco really does stand out as a very expensive place to build. It's if you want to drop in all the political shenanigans that you could put into a city, high regulations, there are policies that actually encourage anyone in a community to raise objections, and those objections can then delay the development of a building, which of course adds costs, which all get passed on down to the eventual buyers or sometimes the taxpayers, depending what type of a project it is. And then there's just kind of the political mood, if you will, of San Francisco, which for many years has not wanted development. By many years, I mean many, many years. Earlier in this century, the city comptroller issued a report, I think, saying that San Francisco, in order for the amount of new housing to actually affect the cost, the city would have to have tens of thousands of new units come on market. You know, we are way behind in what the state is saying we need to do just to meet affordable housing goals. And this has led to pressure and lawsuits and all of that kind of stuff between the city and the state. Ongoing, we're going to see this flare up during the mayoral election, no doubt. In this mix, you've got people dealing with something else, which is the current, not a depression, but a recession in housing prices in the city. And this has been going on for a number of years right now. I know this painfully because I sold a place last year in San Francisco. If we had sold it 3 years before, we would have had literally hundreds of thousands of dollars more.
You know, whenever I hear headlines or read headlines about the city in a housing slump, as an observer, it always looks to me like things went from completely ludicrous to totally insane. Our idea of a housing slump is something like a $1 million median price to a $900,000 median price. And so it all still seems to be fairly out of reach to your earlier point about how expensive the real estate here is. Generally, even when we have a slump, it is still completely bonkers. And things that I'm from the South, and trying to explain this to my family who lives in Georgia and Alabama is just a non-starter. I can't even try to begin to help them understand like how thrilling it is to see the median house home price go from completely impossible to moderately crazy. So I get we're in a slump, but it's still pretty crazy out there.
It is crazy. And I think people have been seeing some of the news and hoping that two things would happen. One, that interest rates would finally come down And really all they need is the market signaling that, okay, prices are going to come down. That kind of gets a lot of things rolling. Lenders are more likely to entertain buyers who maybe couldn't buy at a higher interest rate, but they kind of are expecting things to go down. Sometimes interest rates for mortgages will actually start to decline even before the Fed has dropped them officially. I kind of put into all this mix my reaction to the recent agreement that the National Association of Realtors made. The National Association of Realtors is this nationwide, very old, very powerful nonprofit association of real estate agents. They call themselves Realtors with a capital R. And
that's how you know they're important and smart.
I do.
Capital R. You get that capitalization, you're in.
But now the realtors are under fire. The brokerage commission system, which has been around for a long, long time, is something that's built into the basic agreement you make with a realtor. When you hire someone to sell your property or when you're looking to buy another property. And what it does is the seller pays a 6% commission and the seller's realtor takes that 6% commission and splits it with the buyer's realtor. So the two agents basically are splitting 6% of whatever it is your property is. That is largely non-negotiable.
So if you're the seller, you're just going to bake that in, right? You're going to ask for, like, let's say I'm a seller. I'm going to pretend I live on a different planet and say I want, because I want like $100,000 for my home. I would ask for 106 so I could make sure that I can sort of take that all off and pay that commission. Is that where it goes essentially, or does it change the sort of market indicators?
The actual price of your place is going to be set by the market. When someone buying a property is not going to say, oh, well, I know the seller needs X amount of money because the buyer is saying, I only am going to spend a certain amount of money. It's, on the other hand, not a bad thing to build into your opening discussions with your agent, which is to say, hey, I need to get X amount of money out of this because I have to pay down the existing mortgage. I need X amount left for my next purchase or whatever. And then they'll do all the work, the math and the testing of comparables, other properties of similar type in the same area, what they've sold for, and basically see, well, what can they get for it? There's other stuff involved and that's really marketing stuff. So it's like, say this property you've got and the agent finally says, okay, well, I think it would go for 1.1 million. And then you get into whole things of like, well, do I actually then price it at 1.5 million? So I have room to negotiate down, or do I price it at 1 million and hope to get multiple offers that push it up above? There's a lot of gamesmanship that realtors know because they do it a million times. And also those tactics will differ throughout the year and throughout the strength of the real estate market.
So this 6% setup,
yes.
Why is this bad? Why did they get sued and this whole thing get kind of ripped up?
The complaint was that the buyers and sellers didn't have the ability to negotiate it and it was just built in, and that therefore they were overpaying. It wasn't where them sitting down and saying, I want to sell my house. Who can come and give me the best deal as a broker? It was, well, which broker do I want? They're all going to charge the same thing. The National Association of Realtors lost a case, which would have been class action suits, and they had multiple suits that they were facing. The estimates were that if they had fought this further, they would have ended up paying more than $1 billion in fines, fees.
You're fancy. You sold a house. Tell me something. Is this a thing to skimp on? I feel like fighting and being like, I'm going to sue you so I can go on like TaskRabbit and find a realtor for cheaper.
Well,
a thing? Is that where you want to save? I'm not sure that's where I would cut a corner.
Okay. And so listeners, I am on the pro realtor side of this argument just because I've seen what they do and I know the value they bring. But if you're not, you've always had the option of selling or buying without a realtor or as your brother acting as your unofficial broker. There's the marketing expertise that a realtor brings or any experienced broker, but also it's all of their connections. So you talk about kind of like trying to find the broker for the first time. So you rely often on someone who has successfully helped other people you know and trust. But then that broker is also going to have good connections, hopefully, with a title company. If you're doing staging, they're going to have a staging company and they're going to know various tradespeople if you're doing repairs and all of that stuff, and they'll take care of it. You'll pay for it all, but they'll take care of it. And again, their relationships are things you rely on too. And I relied both in my selling and buying last year on those relationships. Those are things that I'm not good at.
Yeah. I mean, if you go on Zillow or like Redfin or whatever, you can always search by for sale by owner.
Yeah.
And you can see the difference. I mean, just some can be very sad and sketchy looking places. They don't stage that well. They're just kind of, I don't know. It looks like they took it with one of those old click cameras. So you can, you know, there's a big difference between the people who invest in that kind of help. All right. So we've got this situation now where no more 6%. How is it going to work now?
So I got into this whole discussion because people have been claiming that this is going to mean prices are going to go down. You as a seller will negotiate with your potential broker, and you as a buyer will negotiate with your potential broker. And the assumption in these predictions is that each of them is going to be able to negotiate something less than 3%. Now, the buyer wasn't paying anything before, so the buyer is now going to be paying a brokerage fee. The seller is now maybe going to negotiate it down to, let's say, 2% from the 3%. Well, really, that's 2% down from the 6% the seller would have paid originally or before. But that doesn't mean they're going to lower the price by the amount that they save there.
You know, hope springs eternal, I suppose. You think that that's what's behind the rather optimistic view that this is going to drive down home prices?
I think people are always looking for something to change when you're buying a property and selling a property or buying a property, but you're meeting with your agent. They actually have you sign all these agreements that are showing exactly what you'll be paying for, including who the commission will go to. So you know that ahead of time, unless you're just not paying attention. But still, it's a big complicated issue. So again, the whole reason for using a realtor is someone who knows how to guide you through all those complications and, you know, lower your angst and, of course, get it to the end as well. But for most people, it's still black box because they only do it maybe, what, every 10 years or something. So it's not like they remember all the details. Therefore, it's something like, well, I'm sure something over there can change. This is going to help me because I've just announced this change that supposedly is being done in my interests. It might or might not have been done in your interest, but the outcome is not going to help you unless you're selling a property and you're getting that extra money in your pocket, in which case, good. I think there are arguments that can be made, and I do in my article, that it's very possible the realtors will learn other ways of recouping that since they're also probably doing the staging and the repairs and stuff like that. And they may well build up those prices to compensate. I don't know. But
does it change what the market will bear, though? Because if I'm the seller, I'm the buyer, right? And I've got a budget. I don't have an unlimited resource. I've got a budget of $100,000, and if now I have to pay this 3% commission, now I don't have $100,000. Now I've got, you know, I've got my $97,000 is my maximum that I'm willing to pay because I got to add this thing on top of it. Does it change from the sort of pull side? Even though it's not changing necessarily what the buyer wants a kajillion dollars, you know, and then whatever you can give them. Is that where you might see some market movement is on the what people are willing to offer?
I think it would be more likely in what they're able to buy, which means they might then only be looking at properties that are $97,000 instead of the ones at $100,000. You know, when you go out and you get pre-approved for a mortgage, if you're a bank and it's your money, you're lending on the value of the property. The value of the property, you estimate all that in. You're like, okay, this property is worth that amount, and this person can pay those mortgage payments. The extra 3% or whatever the fee is going to be is not a value to the property. That's so totally something extra. So you would be expecting that to come completely out of the buyer's, you know, own equity that they're putting into the property. I don't think it will affect prices necessarily because you're still kind of talking a marginal amount. But I do think, you know, well, if you're, we were talking $100,000. Well, if you're at $1 million and 3% of that is quite a bit more, well, okay, so you're looking at, you know, $950,000 properties and you're just going to do without the extra bidet in the dining room or whatever.
Bidet in the dining room?
People are weird, I tell you.
You're the expert, man. Okay. Okay. So you don't think that people that, you know, sellers will have to sort of come down a bit to meet buyers who are down a bit. What about, I remember purchasing a house 100 years ago and you could finance, it was sort of a separate financing, but you could, it wasn't a mortgage, but you could finance the closing costs, right? You could actually, there was sort of a separate loan and that might be a way to, I think, because a bank, you know, they're giving you a mortgage. They obviously think you're good for, you know, $100,000. They certainly think you're good for an extra five or whatever. So they give you, it's an unsecured loan, but they can give you other loans to sort of help you through the closing process. And so I would imagine that this kind of thing would just get folded into those kind of supplemental extensions of credit. It, if it's a matter of getting it done and the bank wants to get it done, they will find a way to get you the money to pay your broker. So we might actually just see sort of a, for a buyer, it not changing too much in terms of how much you need to have.
I think you're probably right. I still think the buyer will come out a little bit worse because, and you really hit the heart of it, it would be an unsecured additional loan, which means you're paying higher interest rate.
Probably.
So if it could somehow be part of the mortgage, yes, you're getting that nice amortized thing over 30 years or 15 years, whichever you do. Unsecured is probably a shorter term. And again, because it's unsecured, it's a higher interest rate. So it's not good news probably for buyers. I would love to know is actually how many people actually do buy at the very top of what they're able to. Because, I mean, that's just between you and me, listeners. It's probably not the smartest thing to do because then you have kind of no leeway in there. But I think probably a lot of people do. And so,
well, yeah, you get excited. You see, you know, that bidet in the dining room, you're very excited. You go home, you go, oh, it's another 500 a month. We could do that. We could do that, right? Okay, we could do that. We got approved for this excessive amount, right? And even though it's just way above what our budget is, but once you get in there and you're shopping and you're looking around and you're like, those guys aren't going to outbid us. You know, screw those guys. We're going to get this house. And, you know, and you can, there are all these like emotions that they can really drive it up. And I think that people do. And that's a very, I think, normal thing once you're sort of in this bizarro world of trying to find a place, getting back to your, and go, no, we're going to go to the place with just the two bathrooms or whatever is very hard to do and requires a lot of self-control, but it's easy to get carried away. Oh, it's just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm looking for is like just exactly how, because here's what we got. We've got, to your point, sort of a black box situation on the sell side, right? Because you're just kind of whatever I can get, like, tell me what I can get. And then you also have, since you have now purchased and sold a place, you know that there is literally a wheelbarrow full of documents that you have to sign. And look, you're a smart man. You're a conscientious man. Did you read every line and footnote? I wouldn't necessarily bet on that. And it's okay. You had a Sherpa, you had your realtor, it's fine. But given those two factors, there is a 100% chance they're going to find a way around this, right? Like it's going to be baked in some other place. They're going to call it something else. It's a finder's fee. It's a San Francisco, what is it? The Healthy San Francisco mandate, whatever they put on the bottom of the check. Like, you know what I mean? Like you put it in there. And they will just say, hey, do you want to do this like normal? And people will go, yeah, let's just do it like normal. And then the seller will pay 6% and we will be right back here. They're just going to change the language. It's just such a closed and confusing process. There's just no way they won't find a way to kind of get cute with how this goes. So to your point, you know, will it change for the better, the housing market? Unlikely.
I agree. I don't think it'll change the market for the better. Except that, on the other hand, because the National Association of Realtors itself is changing its system, that means every realtor does not need to follow that. And if you're a very successful realtor in a market, you're right. You're going to be fine. You're going to have these other ways of bringing in that revenue. If you're maybe new to the market as a realtor or things aren't going as strong in your business side, well, then, yeah, you might well come in and say, okay, he's going to do it this old way and you're going to be paying him 3% and you're going to pay her the other 3%. I'll take 1.5%. It's possible that there actually could be, again, on the margins, a little bit of goodness. I suspect that would still mostly be on the seller side. Buyers, yeah, if I were buying right now under this and looking to do the smartest thing, I would buy a little bit under what is the maximum of what I could afford. And I would put in the dining room bidet myself later.
Well, one thing I have heard about this is that it will drive part-time realtors out, essentially. You just had a lot of people who were doing it sort of as a side gig. part-time or work from home or, you know, just every other weekend kind of thing. And that those folks, if you can't really stay in the game. Now, here's the other concern though. If you're a really good realtor, let's say your person who you've now used multiple times, who, you know, is really great, says, hey, John, I charge 7%. Right. I charge 5% or maybe something smaller, maybe something a little more reasonable. I don't charge 3%. I charge 4%. You know, you might see things like that. I mean, one of the things that the 3% did is it kept a ceiling too, not just a floor on the price of really fancy realtors. You know, people got TV shows selling real estate. It's bananas. So, I mean, if you're a star, maybe you can actually do better for yourself.
You might, yes, all those shows like Million Dollar Listings, which of course in San Francisco is almost every listing. Those
meanwhile, it's a shack.
Oh yeah, it's a fixer upper with no parking, Noe Valley or something like that. Actually, that's a lie. If it were Noe Valley with no parking, it's
fixer. It'd be free.
Still be, yeah, exactly. 3 million. That's the situation. And of course, I'm gonna give the weasel out on this, which is that we'll see how it happens, but and it might just be that it's enough disruption to the way things happen that down the line, there are other innovations in pricing or agent arrangements that maybe are different. You know, we are paying a lot less for our phone service each month than we did back when AT&T was a monolith before it was broken up. This is not a breakup of NAR. I don't mean to imply that, but it is a breakup of the way NAR's members have done business for many decades. So hopefully there will come a new paradigm.
Well, so what would it take? Because I want to play a part of the game with you, because I did this after a debate. I hosted a debate about development in San Francisco. And this was years ago, but afterwards we were, it was at a bar. So we're all sitting around drinking, playing parlay game, which is sort of what would it really take to really bring down prices? Because you always hear of people who've been here since like the 70s who are like, yeah, I bought this apartment for $500 in 1971. And you're like, what? You know, even adjusted for inflation, it's still just extraordinary, the prices people paid. So, so what would it really take to bring down prices in San Francisco? And I will tell you, I'll go ahead and spoil it. What we came up with again after some drinks and a debate was an earthquake. So beat that.
That would bring down prices? Because it would what?
That would bring down real estate.
Oh, it would actually provide so many opportunities for new development. Because we'd have to redevelop everything.
Wow. You're half full for sure.
As far as bringing down things short of, yes, shaking the earth so much that most of the buildings collapse, is the oldest story in the book, supply and demand. Instead of there being maybe five houses in San Francisco or condo units or whatever that are within your price range, and so you've got to choose between them and you're competing against everyone else for whom those are their ideal units. And instead of just five, there are 10 or 15. Well, obviously, it's going to be easier to find one that is within your price range.
But supply and demand doesn't seem to work here. And I think it's because there's just sort of an unlimited demand. And so, like, how much supply would be enough? Let's say you build 100,000. Would that be enough? Would a million be enough? Would people still want to be here? I mean, it's at some point you actually, you know, and that's the fear of the NIMBYs, which is legit, which is at some point you build so much that you start looking insane and then no one wants to live here. And there's some tipping point where you're not even cute anymore. You're just a really horrible megacity. But how do you manage this idea of like just supply demand when it seems like there's an unlimited demand?
What you've just described is actually supply and demand. There's unlimited demand because there's not enough supply. So San Francisco has a long way to go before they have to worry about having hundreds of thousands of unsellable units. I mean, like China, where they literally are building entire cities that no one lives in. San Francisco, as I said earlier, there was a prediction it needed to produce tens of thousands. I don't remember the exact number, but tens of thousands of units just before that would start to have a depressing effect on prices or a slowing down of the increase in prices on housing. San Francisco has done nothing since then to change that. So for the foreseeable future, I think you can expect demand to remain high, supply to remain low, And that means it's a seller's market.
On that happy note, let's wrap it up here and say that's our program. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. Please catch us every week for more of the people and topics that matter to San Francisco.
Don't forget to check out our sister podcast, At the Voice, by John Rothman, offering his daily commentary on San Francisco. Melissa and I will see you again next week. The Voice Weekly is a member of the Voice of San Francisco Podcast Network, all rights reserved.